Hi everyone, thanks for joining us. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome and thank you for joining us for the second in a series of three CMEO snacks titled Decoding Vaccine Hesitancy, Nuances Among Parents and Caregivers. This snack series is supported by an educational grant from Merck, Sharp, and Dome LLC, a subsidiary of Merck & Company Incorporated. My name is Gloria Ibarrera. I'm a full-time public health nurse practicing as a certified school nurse in a high school outside of Chicago and visiting clinical associate professor of nursing at UIC. I'm committed to being a lifelong learner and continue my efforts in improving child health outcomes in our most vulnerable populations through my current practice, advocacy, and teaching. I'm also joined today by my distinguished colleague, Dr. Wendy Wright.
Thank you so much, Gloria, and it's truly my honor to stand alongside you today. I am Dr. Wendy Wright. I am an adult and family nurse practitioner, and I am the owner of Wright & Associates Family Healthcare. This is a primary care clinic located in Amherst, New Hampshire, that is owned and operated by nurse practitioners. We take care of about 6,500 primary care patients. And for the last 15 years, I have served as the nurse practitioner representative to the State of New Hampshire Immunization Advisory Board, an organization designed to improve vaccine intake and vaccine outcomes. So it's truly my pleasure to be here today.
To frame the discussion today, let me just quickly review our learning objectives. Our goal is that after the CME snack, you will be able to incorporate knowledge of the causes of vaccine hesitancy in clinical conversations with parents who may be vaccine hesitant. And on the next slide, you'll see what is vaccine hesitancy. So we had probably heard the term vaccine hesitancy, but what exactly is that? Dr. Wright, let's have you talk about this first.
Absolutely. For every one of you that are listening, I know that this is a topic that you are confronting on a daily basis. And I've been doing this work for 32 years, and I can honestly tell you that it is some of the toughest time right now in the world of vaccines. So let's talk about vaccine hesitancy. And the World Health Organization really sums up the definition for us. And what it really refers to is a delay in the acceptance of or refusal of vaccines, despite having availability to those vaccine services. What I think is really important, Gloria, as we talk about this, is that it's not an all or none. There are many people out there who are absolute vaccine refusers. And I've learned over the last few years that, or over the last 30 years, actually, that those are probably people we're not gonna move the pendulum on. Some of them I have in my career, but that's not truly where I spend a lot of my time focusing. Where I spend my time focusing on are what I call the movable middle. Those people who maybe refuse some or maybe want to delay them or will be accepting but need a recommendation from us. So you can see here on this slide that there really is a spectrum to that. But what I don't want you to do is to lose faith, because we know that we together have the power to move those folks along on that paradigm of vaccine hesitancy.
The movable middle, that's what we'll focus on. So we know what vaccine hesitancy is, but what are some of those root causes that have the vaccine hesitancy? The 5C model explains some of these contributing factors very well. That's on the next slide. Dr. Wright, just go ahead and discuss these with us next.
Absolutely. And for our listeners, some of you may remember that it used to be the three C's, actually: complacency, convenience, and confidence. But it was in 2018 that two additional C's were added in, one being collective responsibility and the other being calculation. So let's just briefly take a look at some of these contributing factors to vaccine hesitancy. Probably for me, the biggest one I see is this perceived low risk of acquiring the illness and those vaccine preventable diseases. I recently heard a speaker say something like this, and it went like this. He said, "Many people in our society would rather do nothing then take a chance on doing something and having something of an adverse event happen. And we see this a lot in parents, that they don't perceive that there is a risk. And even if they do, many people are more willing to kind of sit back and not do anything for fear that if there is an adverse event, how can I as a parent live with that? There are many practices who don't offer these vaccines, who don't stock them. And we know that if people don't have them conveniently offered, if they have to drive 10 miles down the street, it's not going to happen. There's also a distrust that we are seeing, certainly in vaccine safety and even our federal government. And we saw this in a study we did in New Hampshire, where we asked people who didn't vaccinate, who do you trust the most? And they said, I trust you. I trust our healthcare providers. But then when we said, who do you trust the least? It was our federal government. And so for me, knowing that, I never speak to people about the CDC, but I talk to them about the American Academy of Family Physicians or the American Academy of Pediatrics. People have more trust in those organizations. And then, you know, there's this willingness or maybe not willingness to protect other people. And I have this whole group of patients who want to collect more and more information and go home and do their research. So there are a lot of contributing factors that we know can contribute to this vaccine hesitancy.
You noted vaccine availability and also referenced trust, especially from the recent study you shared, so thank you. There are numerous specific factors that fall within these five C's that affect vaccine hesitancy, and we see these come up frequently in our conversations with parents when it comes time for their child's vaccines. Dr. Wright, what are some of those factors?
Gloria, I know you see this every day as you're interacting with the children and the parents who are making decisions, but certainly there's the trust in healthcare. But I do want to remind all of you that study after study has shown that you, I, Gloria, we are the most trusted source for vaccine informations. And I don't take that lightly. I make sure that I use that in my position with my patients to try to influence behavior. There's also that perceived efficacy. I have parents who say to me, well, why would I vaccinate my child against polio? We've eliminated polio. And the reality is we haven't eliminated, and we're seeing a resurgence of many of these vaccine preventable diseases. In fact, when I speak to nurse practitioners and my colleagues, I often say vaccines have become harmed by their own successes because people aren't seeing the diseases that we're vaccinating them against because the vaccines have done their job and we can't let down our vigilance. There's also social media. The algorithms that our social media actually develops. And when you go onto social media and you like something or you search it in your browser, it is going to appear on your social media feed, and you will then be fed information that feeds into what you are researching. So people begin to see these messages over and over that support what they were thinking in their head, even if they're not factual. There's also a time factor. We're giving more and more vaccines out. It takes time to discuss each one of these. And then there's that trust factor in the government, in pharmaceutical companies who are studying these vaccines. There's a lot of factors that go into vaccine hesitancy, but with knowledge and persistence, you and I can chip away at each one of these as we're talking with our parents, as well as with our patients across all age groups.
Yeah, we definitely can't let down our vigilance. You're absolutely right. So we also see some common themes that come up during conversations with parents. For example, in my practice, I often see social media influence on parents for those state mandated vaccines in schools. Dr. Wright, what are some other examples of these themes?
So we talked already about the social media exposure and the algorithms that are developed based on your searches. There's certainly religious reasons, and we're going to talk a little bit about this. I don't think what a lot of people realize is that there's truly only one religious group, and that is those who ascribe to Christian Science religion. where vaccines are not recommended or are that there's some anti kind of vaccine movement there. But the reality is the majority of the religious groups actually support vaccinations. And so I think that's a really important takeaway. There's always the concern regarding thimerosal. We're going to talk a little bit about that in just a couple of moments. The amount of aluminum, formaldehyde, and certainly the concern regarding autism. And I know for me, Gloria, just when I think I've figured out what people are going to say to me, the next thing comes up that I have to then begin to research to be able to allay some of the fears that they've heard in these 30-second media blurbs that they hear on television or even on their social media feeds.
On the next slide, we do see the why behind common themes of vaccine hesitancy. But how do we, as clinicians, as nurses, how do we address them in conversation? Could you discuss these with us?
Absolutely. I mean, I say the following, that 1998, the Andrew Wakefield report that alleged the link between vaccines, particularly the MMR and autism, took us back so many years in the world of the vaccine momentum. And in fact, I saw a statement, I think it was from the World Health Organization, that said, single-handedly, the COVID pandemic took us back just as much as the Andrew Wakefield basically report did. So we know that we've got a lot of work to do. But if people remember this report, and what came out later was Lancet actually retracted that report and actually he fabricated that report, but it really set in place this kind of anti-vax type of movement. But I also think you need to know that this anti-vax movement is actually not new. If you go back to the place like the Spanish flu, people were protesting having to wear masks back in 1918. So this is not new. It's just the way people get access to information is so quick these days that it feels like it's gaining a lot of its own momentum. The whole thimerosal issue, the only vaccine truly that continues to contain thimerosal are the multi-dose flu vials. So when I talk to my parents about this, what I say is I keep no vaccines in this clinic that are not single dose entity. And as a result, there is zero thimerosal in any of our vaccines. And by the way, the MMR vaccine, where this whole thimerosal came from, actually thimerosal has never been in this vaccine. And then we've got aluminum and formaldehyde. And I've given you some information here, but truly when we look at childhood vaccines, there's actually more aluminum exposure in breast milk and formula than there is actually in vaccines. Now, I don't know that that's something I often tell parents, but I also know that formaldehyde is found naturally. People think of formaldehyde as what we see in laboratory experiments, but truly it is found in the body naturally as well. And then 58 million followers have followed an anti-vaccination page across social media. Again, it picks up this momentum. And we talked about religious exemptions, and sometimes there's even a morality issue. You remember when HPV vaccine first came out, people alleged that this was going to, you know, give permission to their children to become sexually active. Never in 32 years of practice have I had an adolescent say, well, I'm going to get that HPV vaccine and then go out and become sexually active. It just is not accurate. But again, people will come up with reasons as to why they will refuse or try to delay these vaccines. I think having a good answer for each of these statements that are empathetic, that help the parent to and the patient to understand that you understand their concern, but then coming back with factual, succinct information to kind of refute that those beliefs or those that information that they've heard is very, very beneficial.
Childhood vaccination disparities often stem from factors like socioeconomic status, race, ethnicity, geographic location, healthcare access, education, and immigration status. In the next slide, we'll look at just the different factors and underserved communities. We can see that these disparities result in unequal vaccination rates among different groups. And those efforts to address them involve improving access to healthcare, increasing awareness about vaccination, providing culturally competent care, and ensuring equitable vaccine distribution. There are some consistent findings when we look at disparities associated with childhood vaccination. Dr. Wright, what else can you tell us about these disparities?
We absolutely know that these disparities exist, and what I'm seeing is that they are increasing. And I think a big part of it is so many folks in marginalized communities don't have access to primary care. If you're seeking care in an emergency room or an urgent care, you're not going to get preventive vaccines. It's just not going to happen. And so finding ways to educate providers and to put providers in communities that need access to care is so important. I, as a nurse practitioner, know that the studies are pretty clear on nurse practitioners that when we educate, we tend to educate in communities where we tend to live. And a lot of those communities are underserved, rural, marginalized communities. So I think that putting primary care into communities where we can be the trusted source of information and we can provide access to these vaccines is also so important. Because if they don't have people who are trusted sources who can talk to them and look like them and can speak like them, there's going to be, and that's true across the board in all communities, there's not going to be an equitable uptake, no matter what we try to do. So I think that's a really important factor. And taking vaccines into communities. I remember during COVID, a good friend of mine, her husband's a pastor. She took vaccines into her church because individuals in her church, many of them didn't have access to healthcare. And it was by using those creative mechanisms like you're doing in the school, where you're bringing services to children in the place that they are learning and that they are in, is so very, very important. And we see that in our practice as well, offering people opportunities to get these vaccines that don't require them to take time off from work. If you're an hourly worker, taking 4 hours to sit in a provider's office to get these vaccines is often a huge barrier to getting access to the vaccines.
The next slide, we'll look at trends in childhood vaccination. With vaccine hesitancy, we know that it varies across different vaccines and also populations. However, some vaccines have historically faced more skepticism and hesitancy than others. For example, MMR, I know that we mentioned it, but the vaccine has faced significant skepticism, largely due to that discredited study linking it to autism. And despite extensive scientific evidence debunking this claim, it still has persisted in some communities, as you mentioned, you know, the followers. So we've looked at some historic trends and the disparities associated with them, but what do we do with those trends? What do they look like today? Dr. Wright, what are the vaccination rates of today? And then what can you tell us about current vaccination practices?
Well, I think that if you take a look at this slide, you'll see that this is the percentage of children that are vaccinated up through 24 months. And there are a couple of big takeaways. Many of these vaccines that are on this slide are actually available in combination vaccines. So for instance, Hib is often paired with the DTaP vaccine, which is paired also with the polio vaccines in a multi-dose or multi-antigen type of vaccine. So why the different disparities? And because a lot of these vaccinations are available in combination vaccines. One of the things we're seeing in our community is that certainly there are babies who are not getting these vaccines. And in fact, the World Health Organization during the middle of the pandemic actually declared that I think the number was somewhere in the vicinity of 80 million people in the world are at risk for vaccine preventable diseases due to the lack of vaccinations that were given out during the pandemic. We've certainly caught up, but our biggest place where we're still lacking is in the world of adolescent care. We're seeing HPV rates are down. We're seeing that men MCV4 vaccination rates, particularly the second vaccine, are down. And I don't know what you see, Gloria, but I can tell you that in my clinic, there are three hard vaccines to get into the arms of kids. They are the flu vaccine, the COVID vaccine, and the and the HPV vaccine. Those are the three that for me, I have to work a little bit harder to get those into the arms and the legs of our kids. But these rates are declining. We continue to see them declining. And for all of us who really believe in community immunity, herd immunity, making sure that the masses are protected to protect others who may not be able to be vaccinated due to a medical condition, this is really so important that we work hard to keep these numbers as high as we can keep them.
The next slide, we'll look at school exemptions and just the driving cause at decreasing vaccine rates, that is school exemptions. So one current topic that impacts vaccination rates are those school exemptions, which is something that I work with regularly in my current role as a school nurse. Although here in Illinois, we do mandate vaccines for entering schools. So we only accept medical and religious exemptions. Dr. Wright, can you tell us about what is going on currently with school exemptions just across the U.S.?
Absolutely. Almost every state in the nation has a bill in front of its state legislators to remove vaccine mandates. So I think that we are at risk for many of these mandates to be pulled away. And I understand that as a country, none of us like mandates, but we do know that mandates work. I come to you from New Hampshire. Our motto's live free or die. You do with that motto what you will, but we have very few mandates. We are only mandated our kids to have the varicella vaccine and then the Tdap before seventh or eighth grade. And so we have very few mandates. I want you to know that we had the highest vaccine exemption rate in the United States ever recorded for kindergartners. We are now at over 3%. You know, and that may not seem like a lot, but when you take 3% of millions and millions of people, that's a number of kids who are vulnerable for diseases that we can largely prevent. And you can see too that the national vaccine coverage for this age group was at 93%. That's down from 95%. Now, remember, folks, that there are three exemptions, right? There is, you heard Gloria talk about this, that number one, that the first exemption is a religious exemption. The second is a medical exemption. Those are people who may have just had a bone marrow transplant, for instance, and are not able to vaccinate or have conditions that do not allow them to get vaccines. Those are actually fairly rare, but it's the personal belief exemptions that have actually been linked to some large outbreaks of, for instance, measles in communities. So those personal belief exemptions are what a lot of legislators are looking at. And you can see on this slide that the light green is medical exemptions only. The darker green, the middle green is medical and religious exemptions, which you've heard us talk about. But look at the number of blue states or the bluish green that now have both the philosophical, also known as personal belief exemptions. And those are the ones that people can march in and say, I just don't want to vaccinate. And schools are allowed to let those kids into school. So I know that this can become a very political conversation, but we do believe that school exemptions, particularly the philosophical or personal belief, are driving a lot of these decreasing vaccine rates and many alleged driving a lot of the outbreaks of diseases.
Yeah, as you mentioned, mandates do save lives. Thank you. And here in Illinois, I do see religious objections, but they are getting fewer. So in my practice, just last year, there was less than 15 religious objections in a school as big as 3,000 students, and that's in a high school. And as far as medical objections or an exemption, there's been only 7, and that was last school year. So I do like to see that continue to trend down. But again, mandates do save lives, so thank you. Next, we're going to look at just the faculty panel discussion. And we would like to just close out our program with some final discussion that we hope will help you in your current practice. Looking at vaccine hesitancy varies, we're already seeing this across different, you know, populations. And we have seen for school nurses on the front lines the importance of education, awareness. That's really, we are in a crucial role in promoting vaccination compliance among our students. And also vaccine administration, when there are clinics available for school nurses to either volunteer in to administer vaccines. I'd love to see more school nurses get involved with, you know, school-based vaccination clinics, or just by providing information on where families can access vaccinations in the community. Also with record keeping and monitoring, that's how I was able to give numbers on religious objections and medical exemptions from last school year, because school nurses maintain accurate vaccination records for all students, ensuring that they are up to date with the required vaccinations for, you know, school and for the state regulations. And also for school nurses to become involved with parents, so just engaging with parents and guardians to address concerns and address questions. As Dr. Wright, you mentioned, we are the most trusted profession, nurses are. So I think offering support to help parents make informed decisions about vaccinating their children is critical. And lastly, I would say collaborating with healthcare providers. So making sure that as school nurses, we are collaborating with local healthcare providers. So for example, if I was in New Hampshire, I would be collaborating with you just to share information and to coordinate vaccination efforts. And really by fulfilling, you know, those roles, school nurses can contribute to improving vaccination compliance among students and really helping to protect individual health and prevent the spread of vaccine-preventable diseases that we discuss within the school community. What else can we just share as final thoughts here, Dr. Wright?
Absolutely. I have a couple of takeaways that I'd love to leave you with. The first is, don't ever underestimate the work that you can do. Any trusted source in a clinic who recommends a vaccine for a family can be that person who can get that family to move the pendulum. I know in our clinic, we have a vaccine champion who is the nurse in the office, and she is frequently the one that's moving these families along and helping to set up strategies to get their kids vaccinated. It's also important that we are constantly working legislatively, being politically aware of what's going on in our state, because all we have to do is go home at night. We may come back to a bill that eliminates some of these vaccine mandates and opens up a lot of our kids and our patients to potentially contracting vaccine preventable diseases. I often say, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. Nurses need to be at the table so that we can be involved in making policy changes to protect the public health of our children and our communities. So you can play a huge role, and don't be afraid when someone asks you about a vaccine or you're recommending a vaccine to them and they want to ask you questions. There was a study done that showed that at least 60 to 70% of parents felt the need to ask us questions. They were still going to go forward with the vaccine. So take a breath, listen to their concerns, and be empathetic. You know, I often say, I was where you were at. I had a child that I had to make decisions about as well. I understand it's a hard decision, but here's what I've done, and here's what I recommend for you. And last, your language matters. When you say to someone, you're due for your vaccine today, we've got it in the clinic, let's get it on board, 80% of those people will take your recommendation. But if you say, how do you feel about that COVID vaccine? Only 4%, that's called participatory language, will actually take the vaccine. So watch your words, use a presumptive language. Presume they're going to take the vaccine, you will find that that strategy works really well. Hopefully I've left you with a few really little clinical pearls that you can take back to your clinic tomorrow.
Thank you, Dr. Wright. You definitely have language matters, using a presumptive approach, and then nurses really do need to be at a table. And when they have a seat, you know, have them pull up a bench for their colleagues. So let's just quickly summarize with our SMART goals, that is specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. What we hope that our audience will take from this presentation to apply to your practice: identify the components of vaccine hesitancy that negatively impact vaccination rates, distinguish the factors that drive vaccine hesitancy and how they influence parent decisions to vaccinate, address driving causes of vaccine hesitancy when having conversations with parents regarding vaccination of their children. This CMEO snack is one of a three-part series. We hope that you'll take advantage of all of the short and focused activities in the series. Thank you again to the faculty for joining me today, Dr. Wright, and thank you to our audience for participating and providing the best care for patients. Thank you.
Thank you.